chairperson the BSCF, chairperson for the Select Committee on Finance from the Select Committee. The, you know, Mr. Brown, I think that we need to check up our language. The Select Committee, the Standing Committee. And we seem to have a challenge of understanding the difference between the two. And I looked at the ENE. I see National Treasury says the Select Committee made these recommendations. Clearly, the Standing Committee on Appropriations never made any recommendations as far as that book is concerned. So I hope that in future, don't look now, don't worry. We're talking about future, we're talking about moving forward, that at least if you mention A, mention B as well, or don't mention, okay, if you say Parliament, it's fine. But now the members are saying, but where are our recommendations? Because these recommendations are our recommendations and what. So we hope that at least moving forward, we will also take that into account. Yeah. Well, we will not apologize for each and every member that is not here, but generally it's a... as we have indicated that they will continue joining us. Honourable members, we have, thank you very much, we have requested for this workshop, as we normally do, pre-budget, pre-MTVPS, because for MTVPS tomorrow, National Treasury will present a number of documents that they do. I'm sure we'll do it again for budget. But it's very important for us as members. It's a pity that there's not many of us here. But we would love that members, as members, we understand each and every one of those documents. And we thought that this would be opportune time for us to engage with National Treasury on each one of those documents. But Noba Babi, Noba Bata together. Alomza Balazangegu Mengoba Abanyavantu Bengeko. Sao Kubega now. So we will continue. We have the Honorable Debius. We also have visitors. I don't see them here. Clearly they have not come. Maybe it's good that we say this up front before they come. They will come. We have visitors, Mr. Brown, from SADC Parliamentary Forum. The SADC Parliamentary Forum is establishing some subcommittees on different themes. So we have visitors from they are establishing what is called the SADC Association of Parliamentary Forum on Budget. Well, they're just walking in as I'm introducing them. You can come up this side and join and sit this side here. So I was saying that the SADC Parliamentary Forum then, amongst those things that they are establishing, subcommittees that they are establishing, is the one for the budget committee, for SADC parliamentary committees. Well, it is at the formation stage. It's not formal. we have welcome. I was just saying that the leadership is delayed, is on the way. You have come. We have two members. I mean, all these members would like to, at SADC Forum, would like to share experiences across, understand what's happening in other countries. So they have decided to join us. We have Honorable Zanda as the acting chairperson, if you can stand, Honorable Zanda. Sure. He is the chairperson of the budget, it's a long name, it's budget, investment and promotion. You'll excuse me if I've not said it correctly, Honorable Zanda. And honorable with him is Honorable Hamududu from Zambia, who is also the chairperson of the budget committee there. They are accompanied by Mr. Rongai Chizema, who is working for an institution or institute that is called the Southern African Support Trust, which is there in Zimbabwe. So you welcome, a gentleman. On that note, I would like to welcome National Treasury and invite National Treasury to address us.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members, for those words of welcome. It's not because it is Monday that the members are not here, Honorable Chairs. I think it is because Jesus lost in the Telkom challenge. So they are, you know, still smarty. Or Sundowns was also out.
You are an official, you can still be chucked out of this.
And Manchester United also got a derby. Yeah. Honorable members, it is a workshop. I think it's important. And chairs, even if a lot of the members are not here, they're coming. I think what is important is the fact that the researchers are actually here, and we would actually expect them to interact quite vigorously with our colleagues here on the matters there. And Chair, as I've requested that as we are done, that we, some of us, move out because of the work that we need to do. But that doesn't mean that the people at the side of the table shouldn't be grilled, because there's a lot of terminology that Joan near the back can use that can sometimes confuse people. You know, she also even confuses the National Treasury, by the way, because sometimes she talks about the budget deficit, the budget balance, the primary balance. And these things, you know, some of us even in the Treasury don't understand them. So we will go through the program without actually compromising the quality of the information here. But I think what is important is if there are questions to be asked, members should feel free to actually just ask those specific kind of questions there. And I think for the members from SADC, honorable chairs, I think you should feel free to take time to also talk to Dr. Brown here, because they are also involved in CABRI and do a lot of budget reform initiatives all over Africa. I think it will also provide you with an opportunity to actually talk to her and get to know what it is that they are doing and how they can actually just interface with your work there. We will be tabling tomorrow the adjusted appropriation bill, as well as the Division of Revenue Amendment bill, and together with that the Minister will table the medium-term budget policy statement. Today's workshop will try and cover those documents in quite a bit of detail without divulging the content thereof. Dr. Brown here, who is the Chief Director in the Treasury responsible in the Budget Office, she will talk to the budget process, the E&E and the adjusted appropriation bill. Joan, here at the back of me, Joan Scott, she's a director. It's written Scott here. Blakey, you'll have to sort it out there. Tembegil. Joan Scott, she's responsible for the fiscal framework actually in the budget office. She will run through those terms, you know, inflation, GDP, etc., primary balances and that. Then you've got Wendy, there with the dark green, the colorful lady. She will talk about the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, how the schedules are structured there. But I also got a very strong lieutenant here next to me, Michael Sachs. He's actually Joan Stotz's boss, if I'm not wrong. And then you've got our chief whip, yeah, Julia the Brain. She's got a very long stick and whip that she normally uses to hit all of us. And then we've got Deborah there, Kangwari. She is working with Joan. And so it is a full team. Actually, then we've got our parliamentary office. They don't need any introduction to yourself. For us, it is always a privilege. I think part of this workshop has got to do with really trying to make the documents that we will be disseminating tomorrow, make them easy for people to understand yourself as well as actually the broader public out there. And as a treasury, sometimes we also struggle to write these things in very simple language so that not only you as parliamentarians can digest it, but also how the ordinary citizen actually can get these documents and understand them quite well, etc. But unfortunately, your primary balance. So it remains that. So as much as we try to actually write some of our documents in very kind of simple language, at the end of the day, certain terminologies will still remain basically there. So today's workshop, as I've said, we will not go into the details of what we will be announcing, but at least we will try and explain quite a bit of the terminology that is actually contained in there. Without any further ado, Honourable Chair, unless you want to add anything, I'll ask Dr. Brown here to just get onto the budget process, the adjusted estimate of national expenditure as well as the adjusted appropriation bill. Okay.
Good morning, Honourable Chairs. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm going to talk to you firstly about the budget process more generally, and then there's a second presentation which will talk to the adjusted estimates of national expenditure and to the appropriation bill, and I'll be led by yourselves in terms of whether in between those two I stop for some questions. Just generally speaking, to say that the budget process is a process by which choices need to be made about government's priorities. In looking at the budget, one is trying to achieve allocative efficiency, which means allocating money towards government's priority areas, fiscal stability, and also sustainability, so that into the long term one remains financially viable. And then also key is service delivery, which we also sometimes call technical efficiency. In other words, even though you've put money towards a priority, is that money being spent as efficiently and as effectively as is possible? Obviously, to the extent that that is done, that frees up some more money to be put towards priorities. Budgeting is, by its very nature, a political exercise. It starts off with political choices about the priorities coming from the various mahotla, and ends ultimately with a political decision around which program and project gets funded. That political process obviously involves the executive and the legislature. There are three interrelated spheres of government which obviously need to cooperate, and the vertical division of revenue, which is tabled at this time with the MTVPS, basically talks to that split across the three spheres, obviously taking into account the priorities of government. Also in South Africa, we use a three-year rolling budget system called the Median Term Expenditure Framework, And in using that budget system, which is really a tool for the way in which we craft our budget, we also stick to the same principles that I've just spoken to, looking at financial sustainability, looking at priorities, etc. Then in terms of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, the Constitution then provides, with the Money Bills Amendments Act, then the powers to Parliament to amend a budget proposal put forward to Parliament. In terms of the government's focus, in terms of priorities, there's an outcomes approach, which is largely championed through the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation. And our budget process is also undergoing reform in order to respond to that and in order to respond to the changes in procedures and processes brought about by the Money Bills Amendment process. And so essentially, since last year, what we do is that for budgeting purposes, we group various votes and the various entities, even across the three spheres, in terms of government function, so that we can focus on the particular outcomes and outputs required in respect of that function, and then look at the various institutions and how they need to cooperate with each other in order to achieve that. And essentially, that is why we've embarked on this functional approach. So just to make an example, in the budget, before we use the functional approach, we would be looking at particular institutions. So let's say we'd be looking at the Department of Higher Education's budget, and we'd look at it from various perspectives. Now what we do is we will look at the education function. So we would look at the National Departments of Basic Education. We would look at the Department of Higher Education and Training. Plus, we would look at all the provincial departments of education and the various entities that are relevant to education together, and look then as a collective at what the outputs are and what the best way is in order to undertake the business of education. In terms of the medium-term expenditure framework, it's also called the MTEF. It's a big jawbreaker, but essentially it just really talks to that three-year budgeting system. So if you look there on the left-hand side, you'll see the last MTEF tabled at the time of this budget in February this year, which had the first year being 2011-12, the financial year starting in April, and then the second year 12-13, and the third year 13-14. Now, as we come to make our preparations for next February, we have to look at the new MTEF, and so what we do is we take the first 2 years as given, and we need to generate the new third year. In generating that new third year, there are some things indicated on the right-hand side that we do. Essentially, we will take that second year figure, the 13-14 year figure. We will look at the general inflationary expectation on that. We'll take that into account. We'll take out any once-off expenditures. So, for example, even in this year, we took out the effects of the World Cup spending, which had come to an end. But where there are those instances in terms of projects and programs of government that come to an end, we take that out. We put the inflation on. We take a look at the fiscal framework, which is informed by the macroeconomic forecasts, and that will also influence what we finally put down as the 14-15 amount, as well as any savings and reprioritization. As we go through the budget process unfolds over the entire year, and we go through various types of analyses, and those all influence what will ultimately be tabled in February. But in terms of what is being tabled now with the MTBPS, the details in respect of the division of revenue are tabled now. Then the various role players, I don't think I necessarily need to go through all of them. I think the members are aware of who the important parties are here. But essentially to say that it is a budget process that aims to involve all stakeholders by various different means and at various different stages within the budget process. The budget cycle, essentially what have we done so far, where are we at now? Well, in terms of where we're at, we've had two submissions from departments. The first one was a submission where they essentially submitted their new estimates of expenditure and how they would spend within their current spending envelopes. Then, as the budget process unfolded and through this functional mechanism, there had been some discussion between the various departments and entities in the Treasury and some of the other central departments like performance monitoring and evaluation and cooperative governance, for example. They also had a second submission where they submitted an estimate which included some proposals for additions. The medium-term expenditure committee, which is comprised then of some of the central government departments, considered these submissions together with the analysis that had been undertaken on them and makes submissions to the Minister's Committee on the Budget. And the Minister's Committee on the Budget then recommended to Cabinet. And then, obviously, with the approval of the executive, we are able to table the medium-term budget policy statement, which has the detail of the vertical division of revenue, but doesn't, for example, have the detail of the allocations to national departments. Also, at the same time as the medium-term budget policy statement, which Joan will speak more to, we also have the in-year process, which allows some adjustments in-year to the budgets of departments. What I have in my hand is the adjusted estimates of national expenditure. There are some in the boxes over there. And I'll talk a bit later to this publication and what you'll find in it. But that is for the current financial year we're in. Then in terms of the medium-term expenditure framework and preparing for our budget that we table in February, we would have a process whereby we finalize the national level allocations, and then we would issue allocation letters to departments, and on the basis of that they would prepare their databases and their documents so that we are able to table in February. In terms of the Money Bills Amendment procedure, we have extra inputs into the budget process in the last 2 years that we did not have before. So we now have the privilege of having the budget review and recommendation reports. These reports set out the issues raised by Parliament in respect of the performance of particular government departments, and these are referred to the Ministry of Finance as well as to the relevant minister. And the recommendations of those reports are then taken into consideration in the finalization work that we do towards going towards February. And when the budget is tabled, the Minister of Finance must also table a report which highlights how the budget and the Division of Revenue talks to the concerns that have been raised by Parliament. And in terms of the Money Bills Amendments Act, if the Minister's explanation does not adequately address Parliament's concerns, Parliament has the power to amend the budget and to take money somewhere and put it somewhere else. In a nutshell, that basically is sort of a visual depiction of what goes on during the year. I think I have actually spoken to most of it. Essentially, if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see the work of the executive. On the right-hand side, the work of the legislature, and in the middle, the work of the various government institutions and how they respond. And what you will note is that in terms of the work of Parliament, there is obviously a time lag, because only once... Would you like me to speak to it in greater detail? Okay. All right. Let's then start on the left-hand side looking at what the role of the executive is. In the beginning of the financial year starts in April, there's a review and an evaluation and a decision regarding what the new priorities of government will be, what the major proposals are, and those decisions and discussions then obviously lead up to the July Lekgotla. But there's also at the same time work going on looking at the macroeconomic projections and looking at a first estimation of what the fiscal situation is going to be. That information then comes about around July. Then from July there's quite intensive work on the budget. And essentially within the departments, as the departments are leading up to the discussions around the Lekgotla, they are using the information about what is emerging as priorities to start preparing the detailed costing around some of the new programs and some of the existing programs that they may need to modify in order to respond to that. The fiscal framework, as it becomes known to them, is also information that they consider in the proposals that they'll be making around their expenditure estimates. At some point in July, they will make a budget submission, and there'll be various intergovernmental and technical forums where the budget, as the budget process unfolds, institutions will talk to each other, talk to entities, and respond to anything that is coming from the Minister's Committee on the Budget or the MTEC and so on. Then in August, the executive, and going into the beginning of September, has to make a final decision around the framework and the division of revenue that will be tabled now, tomorrow, for the medium-term budget policy statement. And there are also the final sector and focused hearings on that. In case you're wondering, I'm purposefully ignoring the role of the legislature now. If you'll just indulge me, I'll explain why. And then what then happens around the end of October, sorry, that should actually be a bit higher up, if we now go to the legislature, is that the budget review and recommendation reports are submitted, and when we table the NTBPS, the legislature will adopt the fiscal framework first, adopt the division of revenue stance, and adopt the appropriation bill with or without amendments as Parliament should see fit. Simultaneously, Cabinet looks at the last proposals in terms of some of the details, or not the last, the penultimate national allocations in order to make a proposal go to departments so that they can prepare their budget documentation. So they issue the allocation letters. Departments then respond by finalizing their budget inputs. In January, there's not a block there, but in January, there's another reassessment, and there may need to be a refinement. And if that is the case, there may need to be other allocation letters issued. Then there's the tabling of the national budget, and it includes the response to the budget review and recommendation reports. 2 weeks after that, the provincial budgets are tabled, but departments around about now also table their strategic plans. After this, in terms of the Money Bills Amendment procedure, the legislature goes through the same process with a longer lead time in terms of passing the budget. Firstly, looking at the fiscal framework and adopting a fiscal framework, and then looking at the division of revenue and passing a division of revenue, and ultimately the appropriation bill and revenue bills. You will note also that in response to the medium-term budget policy statement, the Parliament has to go through those steps, but very, very quickly, in a very short timeline, but also sequentially passes those various steps. That's, I think, enough said about the budget process generally for now.
Thank you. I don't know if you want someone to speak more perhaps on this, or we just move to another one. Let's just have all these honourable members, with your permission, can we engage with this one, or do you want us to move to the others? Sorry. Okay. Ms. Dot.
Sorry, Chair, I still actually have another one. The one on the adjusted estimates of national expenditure. Yes, actually, I was being my boss, who's in with the minister at the moment, up until now. So now I can be myself. Should I proceed? Okay. So now I'm going to talk in a little bit more detail about the adjusted estimates of national expenditure. Essentially, please note that I'm now not talking about the three-year proposal of the budget going forward, but I'm literally talking about the amendments to institutional budgets within the current financial year. So if you look at the beginning of this document, you'll see that right at the beginning there's an introductory section, and there's a section which also has an explanatory note on the information in each chapter. If you look to the introduction, there's always some discussion of the annual budget process, which I think we've just had a discussion on. And then also the various kinds of adjustments that are allowed in year, which are permitted in terms of Section 32 of the PFMA, are then explained in greater detail. There are also some summary tables in the front which summarize for all the departments what the effects of these adjustments are. So if you were to look at table 1, you'd get a sense of the quantum of the adjustments, which type of adjustments they are, and then how they affect the budget balance. So how they affect expenditure, you'll also get some information on what the in-year, if there are any adjustments to the projection of revenue, and then you can see if there's any adjustments that are being tabled in terms of the budget balance. Then you'll get in greater detail per vote the information about the different kinds of adjustments and any changes to the national, to direct charges on the National Revenue Fund. You also get that information by economic classification, so that's for current payments, payments for capital, payments for financial assets, and transfers and subsidies. Then there's specific information, summative information, on the rollovers by department. So if you're only interested in rollovers and you want to see which department's got rollover money for what, you can look at that. A specific summary table also on departments that got funding for unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure, and then also any adjustments due to significant and unforeseen economic and financial events. You can also see the details of that. There's some self-financing expenditure. Self-financing is when the activities of a particular department generate revenue. Departments may ask for that revenue to be awarded to them for expenditure, and that is called self-financing expenditure. The details of that is then also provided. Also, any information where institutions have declared savings, and also information about the level of underspending that we as the Treasury are projecting given the information that we have. Then there's also information on the expenditure outcome of the previous financial year, and particularly the information for the first 6 months of that year in comparison to the first 6 months of this year, and the similar information on departmental revenue. So that you would see in summary form at the front of the book, which I think is quite useful if you kind of want to compare, particularly for Parliament and so on, if you want to compare a particular kind of allocation of money across different departments to see if there are particular trends emerging and so on that you would like to investigate further. Then the information in each chapter talks to a vote. Broadly speaking, a vote consists of one department normally, but in some cases there's more than one department that is housed within a particular vote. And when you look at the order of the votes, it's informed by functional groupings that you see up there. But essentially, for each and every vote, you can get quite detailed information, and I'll explain very briefly what that is. So the order of each of the chapters is exactly the same. It starts out with an adjusted budget summary. So on the left-hand side, you can see the main appropriation, which tells you what was tabled in February. Then the adjusted appropriation, which tells you what, if the proposal that we are tabling now, if it goes through as unamended, then essentially the adjusted appropriation would be the new appropriation amount. And you've got the two columns on the right-hand side, which will indicate whether that is an increase or a decrease that is being proposed and the amount thereof. You've got the new amount, and then you've also got them divided by economic classification information. And then at the bottom, you've got the accountability information for a particular vote. So that's the first table in each department, so that you can literally see what is being proposed at a very high level. I won't go through that, but that is for the information of members and for the information of researchers. It explains exactly what for each of those columns and each of the rows, what the particular definition is of what is put in that particular cell. Then there is a discussion of the aim of the department, and the aim may have changed. For example, if a new department is declared and a function has shifted and so on. But there is a specific section there just below that which indicates to you what the changes are to any particular program, purpose, or the objectives and measures. And the idea here is to link the in-year adjustments documentation with the documentation that was tabled at the time of the budget, so that you can clearly draw that link. You've got then the primary indicators of an institution listed, those that were published in the ENE. You then also have what is projected now for the year, which may be different or not from what was tabled in the ENE. You have a column which talks to what has been achieved in the first 6 months, so you can compare that relative to what was meant to have been achieved for the year. And you have an indication right on the right-hand side of whether or not there's any change in performance against an indicator projected. And below that, you would have information on why this would be the case. So if the budget is being amended for that particular program, it may influence the performance of that program, or if there's been a function shift or change in mandate, etc. But that should be set out there with the reasons for that. Then for each particular, or for the department as a whole and by program, you have an indication of the main adjustments that are made in year, and as I said, this is in terms of Section 30 of the PFMA. So you start on the left-hand side where you can see what was tabled in the main a budget. And then the first column will show you any rollovers that are being proposed per program, and then at the bottom, per economic classification. The second one, looking at any unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditures, just giving you the numbers at this point. The third column, any variance and shifts, you can see the amounts there. And then the fourth one that is under adjustments appropriation is the other adjustments. So those three that have just been named are the main ones. But then there are others like amounts announced at the time of the budget that weren't allocated, any funding for disasters, and so on. Those are in other adjustments in this table, but there are details further on which will tell you exactly what it's for. You then have the total of the adjustments. If you add that total change in terms of the adjustments to the main appropriation, right at the end you get the adjusted appropriation that is being proposed. Then for each program within the department, you get the same information by sub-program.
Mr. Brown, may I disturb you?
Yes.
I thought that you were going to finish, you know, but I can see you're going to take a little bit of time. You will proceed now. We don't have a problem with that. The honorable members, our guests, and I'm being persecuted because the tea is getting cold. But we're not going to break for tea. I would just like those people who want to take tea, they are welcome to take their tea and come back to their seats. You may proceed, please. David, come on.
But that just explains what I've basically just said. So I won't read that. Then you actually get in the document the details then of the adjustments. So you get a section which deals with rollovers, and it will tell you that there's a rollover in a particular program and what that money is being rolled over for. It will be something that should have been completed in the previous financial year, but which was not completed, and hence the funds will be rolled over to ensure completion. The same, you'll get details on unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure, explaining the amount and the particular circumstances around why that funding is being proposed. You also get information on all the other kinds of adjustments, whether that is emergency funding or disaster funding, whether that is an amount that was announced at the time of the budget, it wasn't allocated, but we are now allocating it to Program 3, for example, and so on. Also have information in terms of gifts, donations, and sponsorships proposed by this institution. Also information around any changes to direct charges against the National Revenue Fund. Remembering, for example, there that the provincial equitable share is a direct charge. So if there's any reason that needs to be changed, then that would be an example of that. And then you get information also on variance and shifts. And here I just need to stop for a minute to say what the difference is. Variance is when money is moved between two different programs within a vote, where shifts are just moved within a particular program. And essentially, in terms of variance, the PFMA deals with that under Section 43, but in terms of shifts within a particular program to various sub-programs, there are not criteria against which that takes place. In order to be very transparent about the variance, and in order to ensure that everyone understands what money is proposed to be shifted for what, we have it split into two sections. We have the from section on the left and the to on the right. So for each program, you are able to see by economic classification you can, it is listed where the money is to be taken from. The motivation column tells you why that money is not going to be spent as it was proposed in the main appropriation bill at the time of the budget. And obviously you have the amount there. And then on the two side, you have exactly that money that's being taken. You have the detail of which programs it's going to. It might go back into the same program, but it might go to another program. And you have why this program needs to spend more. And then at the bottom there, you have a percentage which indicates to you this money that is coming from a particular program. What percentage of the budget is that? Because Section 43 says it may not be more than 8% unless Parliament would approve that. One just has to be slightly careful because in some cases if the money has gone to the same program, then you just need to deduct that before working out the percentage finally. But essentially, what we have footnoted in each of these chapters is which decision on environment is a decision for Parliament alone, that Treasury cannot approve, that the accounting officer cannot approve. And then also we indicate which of these environments Treasury has already approved. So that those that are for Parliament to approve, those that Treasury has already approved, they are separate, but the rest are what the accounting officer is setting out. That just basically explains the same thing. I don't think I need to go through that again. And then essentially you have a table. Again, this is for the vote and looking at it by program and by economic classification. It's looking at the expenditure for last year, the adjusted appropriation, in other words, what was in effect after Parliament had approved, comparing then the April to September, the first 6 months expenditure, against the adjusted appropriation as a percentage, and then also the full year's expenditure against what was the adjusted appropriation. Then for the current year, obviously, we only have the 6 months information, so what the adjusted appropriation there is what is being proposed and being tabled, and then the 6 months information taken in comparison to what is being proposed as the adjusted appropriation. So that you can see in the first 6 months of last year, for example, this institution spent 43% of its budget. Now it's proposing to spend 63%. Something must be explaining that. If it's not clear, then clearly that will be a concern that will be taken up in Parliament, I would imagine. That just explains what each of those things are. You also get a little section under the main expenditure trends, which should explain to you, if you see that big discrepancy, 43% last year in the first 6 months, but now 63% proposed, there should then be some explanation of this, which should be rational. If not, then obviously that is something that can be probed, but that will be the information that is being given to us by the department. Departmental receipts, pretty much the same thing. You can see the adjusted estimate for last year and the 6 months and the annual comparison to that. And then for this year, the adjusted revenue estimates and the 6 month comparison. And again, at the end of that, there will be some explanation for those revenue trends. And then at the end of the chapter, you have a description of changes in transfers and subsidies. And transfers and subsidies include conditional grants. There are actually two tables there. My apologies, it doesn't look very clearly like it's two, but there are. The top one then gives you the numbers of the change in the transfers and subsidies by the type of adjustment. But then the bottom table would actually be headed, for example, a conditional grant to provinces, and it would name the grant and show you which type of adjustment is effected and therefore the change in the conditional grant. And then you could also have a heading changes to local conditional grants. So that then would give you the full detail. Then obviously, well, not obviously, but this is the explanatory note to the Adjustments Appropriation Bill, which obviously is the law. It's a long explanation, but that is very important that it be a long explanation so that Parliament can properly consider what is being proposed. It's a very important tool for oversight, both the explanatory notes and the appropriation bill itself. And essentially, it sets out the adjustments as proposed, and any spending, as with the main appropriation, even with the adjustments appropriation, any spending is in terms of the PFMA and in terms of any of the clauses contained within the Act. And we also have the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, which will also talk in further detail at the sub-national level to some of the higher level figures that are contained in here. But if you look at the bill itself, you'll see that the bill is structured by vote, and for each vote then you would see an aim, which would just remind you what the aim is. It's normally just the same as at the time of the main appropriation, unless a new department, for example, has been created. And then you'll see by program, the programs are listed. In the case of the adjustments appropriation, we might skip a program. If there's a particular program for which there's no adjustments proposed, then you wouldn't see that. But basically, by program, we indicate the adjustments, and we indicate those adjustments. Also, we break that down to current payments, transfers and subsidies, payments for capital, payments for financial assets. So Parliament would be able to see, for example, if there's money moving away from capital, for example, to current payments and so on. So one would be able to monitor those trends. In the case of some programs, you have of which information, in other words, a subset of information, and often there's a heading which tells you what kind of adjustment this is. The important thing is if it's marked with a star, with an asterisk, then it's specifically and exclusively appropriated by Parliament. Treasury sometimes does what we call treasury earmarking in allocation letters. But the specifically and exclusively appropriated by Parliament is a much harder condition, and it means that departments may not spend money that is indicated like this on anything else. So even though it has the powers to via, it can't via this money without coming back to Parliament for that permission. Also, please to note that the conditional grants are also specifically and exclusively appropriated. Thank you very much. That I think is enough said about the bill and the adjusted E&E.
There are interesting points that have been raised. Maybe I should welcome our colleague there, Honorable Matomel Hachola. You're welcome. That's fine. Well, we can go to the next one, presentation. Excuse me. You're done? Sure. You want to go? Is that what you're saying? Because there is a request for them to leave, maybe we should deal with this part so that when you go, we know that we have dealt with this part. Can I invite questions now on our members?
committee chairperson. Looking at this presentation, I've been trying to filter in our role during the process as appropriations and parliament. Because when we start looking at page 6 and looking at all those role players in the budget process, legislation is right there at the end.
Sorry, Honorable Mashiko, if I may just disturb you. You're referring to that...
To this presentation as a whole.
Oh, okay.
Out of this.
Oh, I thought that is a specific section. So, all right.
Because I thought... I don't know whether you want to structure it according to sections or as she presented it. I don't know. Because we look at these role players, and this is a budget cycle. Somewhere along the way, it should boldly say what the role of parliament is, because it starts at cabinet, ministers, and all these departments and all, and at the bottom is us. And then the constitution specifically, when it came to draw the Money Bill Act, when it refers to the establishment and the passing of the Money Bill Act, I think it had seen all these flaws in here. And again, when you go through it, it does not satisfactory. Maybe it will say, because this is a second. And in the very same Money Bill Act, we are mentioned, but we are not mentioned here. I think I'll be right to say Section 12. The Money Bill Act talks about rules. And Section 12.16 talks about all those rules, what should be taken into consideration. Maybe the answer will say there are no rules. What should be taken into consideration? And Section 12.16a specifically refers to the committee, Standing Committee on Appropriations, which is our committee, which it states that it should, I mentioned the word, mediate. That's Section 12.16a. I remember very well that one. It's 12.16a. Standing Committee on Appropriation should mediate during the BRRR. Nowhere are we mentioned as part of parliament. Even going through this, there's nowhere where National Treasury mentioned that we should be recognized. It's just that the BRRR should go to the ministers or treasury. And then it's the end of it. And then we are sitting here listening to this, and we are not mentioned, and we are a very, very big role players who are going to pass all this. And the people down there, the people who voted us in, would like to know from us, why did you pass this? There are environments which surpass us through the Section 43. Everything surpasses us, but at the end of the day, I'm complaining because at the end of the day, we are the ones who stand there and say, pass. We support the bill, we support the adjustment, we support everything. I think the Constitution and the Money Act has told us what we should be doing, and not only be sitting here when there's this pre-budget workshop, so that we must be conscientized and enlightened that we are, after a few days, we'll be debating, and we must remember that we must pass whatever was tabled tomorrow. That really doesn't augur well with this committee, I think. We want to see our role. We want to know that when, at what level, we want to know at what level before this adjustments are being done, are we, as the Committee of Appropriation, being at least taken into confidence and said, you know, we are going to adjust. But really, what we are adjusting here, this role over here, from there to there, doesn't satisfy us. What are you, as a statutory committee that deals with expenditure, what do you think? Because we sent quarterly reports, we sent everything to you. What do you think should be done about this before we are going to present this adjustment or before we pass the budget in February? No, nowhere. But that's what we, when does our role literally come in? Should we then be saying, is it because we don't have rules, because we want those rules, if that's the effect? We are already implementing the money bill, and we can also, in the same voice, implement what we feel should be adjusted and not adjusted, which committee should go to what firemen should be done, because we know these firemen and things, they run around us. They run around us in the name of this, in the name of this book, which we all as committee members carry along, and we so know that it really disadvantages us as committees. We would like to do something, but I think we'll get better answers to say at what role, at what time are we taking into consideration as the Standing Committee on Appropriation or as Parliament, because we are a little stakeholder here, but next week we'll be a very big stakeholder because we'll be supposed to be passing these adjustments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mashiko. Just for clarity, in other words, you're saying, could I take that the question of the role of Parliament is not only just on adjustment, but generally on the whole, what you call a budget process? Am I right that you raise it in that context? Yeah. Any other comment? I think that are you right, Commissioner? Do you want to make a comment?
A quick remark regarding the input just made, referring to the legislation, where the legislation say that we do our work in consultation with the other portfolio committees or select committees on the budget or amendments. Now, that in future we invite all the other chairpersons of portfolio committees and select committees to a workshop like this. Because to repeat and repeat and repeat is the best way of learning to improve yourself. Prior to the budget process and prior to the MTBB tabling, that in future we will have to go to the old assembly chambers for this type of workshop to get all the chairpersons going through this process to be on top of it. That's my proposal, Chair.
Okay, but before National Treasurer comes in, I think that the the issues that are being raised, I suspect that they are bigger than this forum where we are in today, because I suspect that they border on constitutional, what you call, matters. Question is, where does Parliament come in? Why does Parliament is there? Is it on the bottom of your consultation process? But you will, what you call, respond to that. But my own, what you call, clarity is on page 8, ne? On page 8 on the document of your general overview. As my colleague has indicated, that we are the committee that deals with as appropriation, whether we whether it's NSOP, but the whole appropriation is around spending, it's around, yes. Now, on the, you look at the pattern of spending throughout the year, up to the third quarter, you find that there's consistent spending, whether slow department is spending slowly, or whether the department is a bit, its expenditure is high, you're able to monitor it. Come the fourth quarter, there's a spike. Now, the issue that really bothers us as parliamentarians is that money must be spent to, there should be outputs. There should be outcomes at the end. If the money, if we take, for instance, housing, your human settlement, if that department spends, has not been spending, or its provinces, its provincial department has not been spending throughout the year, come the fourth quarter, the spending jumps. Now, the question we ask as public representatives, is this spending, does it translate to the actual output on the ground? Does it mean that this month, for instance, there are more people who have got access to housing units than they were for the rest, for the best part of the year? The reality of the matter is that it is not true. But so that now the question is, where is this money gone to? It's been spent. But where is this money gone to? And the contradiction is that the following quarter, the first quarter, the spending slips down for the first quarter. Now, the fourth quarter, there's ups, a huge spike. The first quarter from April, it goes down, it dips down. At the end of the quarter, the spending is 17%, whatever. Now, you spelled out the whole process of the MTEF. A rolling process. Now, to us, it's saying that the people know exactly what they will they are going to be spending for in the first quarter. In fact, looking at page 8 of the very first presentation overview of the budget, it talks about planning and everything. Now, the question says, where does Parliament fit in? In the whole, what you call it, process. So, I mean, question that was raised. Now, to us, is there planning? Is that planning? Who monitors that there is planning? Department A has spent. If Department A, you can see that here, clearly, we look at the expenditure, we see that, why are you not spending? Now, the reasons that they will come with, no, we're busy with tenders, or we've been taken to court, or whatever. But, you know, for slide 8 and 9, that process, is that process followed to the letter? If not, why is it not followed to the letter? But if it is followed to the letter, why do we continue to encounter problems? Because we should just have easy, what you call, work as Parliament. That we look at the expenditure at the first quarter or whatever quarter, you find that now the spending is fine. Because where it matters, at the planning, what you call, the time, that planning has been done. And this report says, where is that? On page slide 8 or page 8 says between April and June, departmental planning and budgeting. Departments prepare budget, including detailed spending plans for the new proposals. Detailed spending plans, you know? Is this thing working? Is it working? We also ask this question to the departments, that do you think that the MTF is working, or we should just throw it out of the window? Go back to the old system where there was no, what you call it,
where there was no MTF, so that people, we know that, well, there's no planning. Everybody is just business as usual. I mean, you wake up one day, if you didn't sleep well, then you can take the whatever item away. And, you know, I mean, for me, really, it makes me angry, you know, because I suppose that these processes are laid out for spending, to ensure that there is spending. So I think the question that my colleague raises is, where does Parliament in the whole, what you call it, system comes in? Should Parliament have a role or not have a role? We passed the Constitution. It talks about separation of powers. The executive must do this. Parliament will only come in later and monitor what is this. But really, the issue of planning, is there someone who is responsible to ensure that Department A has planned or not planned? Or not planned. If they have not planned, why shouldn't they not plan? But is this the whole process, is there somewhere where it is, shall I say, written down somewhere, so where each one of us, as members of parliament or anyone, I know that, well, this system is written down. If I get from this book, you'll get this process. It is there. So that if I ask a question to the department, I'm able to draw from that book. The PFMA, the Treasury Regulation, all these articles, so they are saying this must be done. But is there somewhere where you can really get to these details that are supposed to be done? So that you can draw, I mean, you can draw from, I can go to the Department A and say, but did you follow this process? And if not, who is responsible? Who's supposed to do oversight over it, to monitor it, to ensure that they have followed these processes, so that we don't have a problem when the spending time comes? That's just one, what to call it, comment that I would like to make. But the other comment, that one would like to make is the rollovers. Not the rollovers. This unallocated funds. Why do we have unallocated funds? We have funds that are put there as for disaster. Is it the same thing? The disaster and unallocated funds. But if we're doing the unallocated funds, I mean, if they are not one and the same thing, I think there's trouble there. Who is going to be, when is this unallocated funds going to be allocated? I didn't get it clearly whether we were saying now in the process of adjustment they will be allocated. Just last, the last comment is around the at the end of each quarter, when we receive reports that have information around the whole lot of information, performance information, it is there. But now, if we receive the second quarter report with the adjustment, will it contain that performance information? So that we can really be able to, it's not just figures, because, you know, figures, they don't mean much. We need to have that performance so that we can understand that the intentions of the budget are being achieved. Figures can really distort, because in the program, figures will tell you that you find that in the program, or we do a benchmark of roughly 25% should have been spent in this. and people will spend 25%, but only to find that a lot of funds, a lot of money was spent on a particular program, not on other programs. So it can mislead you if you don't read, don't sit down and analyze it. Now, I'm saying it's fine. We're able to, we want to measure, we want to see what has been done, why we should adjust or not adjust. But is that, will that information be there? Okay. I don't know if my colleagues would like to, you're welcome to ask, that's why you're here, to learn. Honorable Zan, sorry? Honorable Matamela? Honorable Van Four.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the problem really we have been confronting for many years is the issue of under expenditure. And as the chairperson correctly indicated, it's disturbing that in the last quarter there will be what we call the March spike, which I take it as dumping of funds into municipalities and so on. The second area is the issue of procurement plans. I don't know when can we be provided with the procurement plans by departments according to quotas. Because I would love that if the first quarter starts in April, everything which is related with procurement is done, you know, during the fourth quarter or so. So that once the budget is tripled, department can start, you know, spending in terms of the percentages allowed by EPFMA. I don't think we are doing justice to our people if we allow this situation to continue. Lastly, Chair, I don't know whether we do have national norms regarding the split between personnel and non-personnel budget. Because what I'm observing is that the budget for compensation of employees is increasing at a high rate. And then you wonder, what are these people doing when we are underspending, you know, on the delivery of services? So this do not tally. So we can't allow this situation to go on, you know, in the fashion it is now. So I don't know whether the National Treasury have got plans, you know, to cap this kind of situation. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable, thank you, Honorable Matamela. Honorable Van Four.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Just two issues. The first one, the unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure, I see it's at 2.6 billion. I know the detail might be in this big book, but one just got it now in the morning. I've not gone through it to check the details. If just briefly they can highlight what informs this the unavoidable and unforeseeable expenditure. And the last one, the higher than expected personnel remuneration adjustment costs, which is at 6.2 billion. Why do we have this? Because I think the observation is that it has come to be noted that we under budget. I will take it, it's related to salary increases and so on. Year in and year out, we under budget this program. And we know when the time comes that the unions, mostly now, they are looking at a double-digit increment, if you speak about salary increment and so on. Why can't we reach that as treasury? Because I think there are also forums where we meet with regards to a collective bargaining forums and so on and the like, which would give us an indication. But we find ourselves even budgeting below the inflation rate with regards to this particular one and so on. And at times it also gives problems to the provinces, because at times they find themselves wanting if they will have to deal with this particular item.
Thank you very much, Honorable Zanda, Honorable Hamdudu. Any questions?
Not quite, Chair. Thank you very much. Yours is a different problem than ours. Yours, you are failing to spend. Ours, we can't spend. We don't have to spend. I just want to make a comment. It's a quite different one, you know.
Honorable Amdudu.
Just a quick one. Similar to what the Honorable was saying, in Zambia we face the same situation. The absorption capacity of ministries, and we face the same situation. At the end of the year, so much money remains unspent, goes back to the treasury. So we seem to be facing the same problem.
Dr. Brown?
You know, I blame Mr. Brown, who said that you mustn't let us off lightly. I'm going to, if you'll indulge, I'm going to start somewhere in the middle with the slightly easier ones. In terms of the unallocated funds versus the contingency reserve, they are actually two separate things. The problem. The unallocated funds, it is, for example, in the last budget in February, we indicated that there's 800 million set aside for the green economy, but it is unallocated. The reason for that comes back to your concerns around the planning. Knowing that it is an important priority, knowing that we have COP on our doorstep, etc., knowing that we need to have some spending in order to have a green economy going forward, some money was put aside because of some tentative planning information that was put forward. But the planning information did not give enough comfort that we felt that we could come to Parliament and say, please give Department X 400 million and Department Y 400 million over the MTEF. Hence, we announced there's this amount of money that has been set aside. The allocation to a particular department is contingent upon proper planning and proper costing. And the allocation of those funds can only happen via the parliamentary process. So there's no way in which Treasury can allocate. So either those funds, and you'll discover tomorrow, either those funds will be proposed for allocation now, or they won't, and they will remain with the fiscus. But the plans are not up to scratch for us to feel comfort to come to Parliament. The contingency reserve is a reserve that we always set aside. We set that aside for these kinds of technical adjustments that we need to make in year, for example, a disaster occurs, and so on and so forth. And also, if you look at the contingency reserve, in the third year, it's much more. And that is to allow the policy space, the greater policy space in the outer year. So in the year you're in, you're basically just doing technical adjustments, because if people haven't done their planning, there's no way that you suddenly want to give them money for policy purpose, for policy priorities, but the plans are not on the table. So there are two different things. Then, I'm just trying to think how best maybe I should come back to Honorable Mashego's comment. My humblest apologies if I have given the committee at all the impression that Parliament is not important. It is somewhere in my presentation, but I was kind of summarizing and going a bit faster. In actual fact, the budgetary process starts in the year ahead with those budget review and recommendation reports. And if we don't have those as an input, then we would not know before we started tabling the budget in February what Parliament's views were on certain issues. And I I do apologize, but I had not. I've got another presentation when I do the Moneyball's amendment procedure and so on, when we have foreign delegations, and I go through the rules and the procedures, but I omitted that, and I'm sorry for that. But essentially, you know, the budget process and the parliamentary process, it's not just a one-day event, and, you know, it's only tomorrow that that the views of Parliament would be important. In fact, from the Treasury's point of view, I think, you know, we would welcome an even stronger role of Parliament, because Parliament is the only body that can really hold the institutions to account. Whereas we can sit at the Treasury and monitor things and say, oh, we see you haven't performed against this, but the money is flowing, etc. There's a limit to what we can actually do about it. We can see it, but we cannot act, and we don't have powers to instruct departments to do certain things. So apologies if I have given the wrong impression here. Certainly the role of the legislature, I think, you know, needs to be strengthened as we go forward. And certainly through the information that comes from the various portfolio committees, from the finance committee, select and standing, the appropriations committees, all that information, you know, is taken back internally and worked on, etc., and considered as we put the proposals forward. And obviously, even then, the discussion continues. So my apologies for that. And I think it does come back to the questions around, for example, the performance information and quarterly performance information. The national departments, for example, in terms of the new strategic planning guidelines, which will come into effect from the next financial year, will need then to table quarterly reports on their performance. And, you know, they obviously Parliament could insist that those reports be made available at Parliament as well. And obviously accounting officers can be called by Parliament at any time. But I think that's exactly correct. We try our best, and I think we've had some success, at least in terms of, if the open budget index is to be believed, in terms of being transparent around what the money is going for, why, and so on. But certainly sometimes I think we also even feel that we've been given detailed costing information, and we are sure that the program should unfold like that. We then propose a budget to Parliament, and then somehow the money doesn't get spent, and so on. You know, so I do think the plans are important, but sometimes even when the plans are there, the institutions don't act according to the plans for whatever those reasons. And I think we share Mr. Sorgoni's frustration with that kind of situation, fully aware of the fact that money that has been allocated to a particular institution, because we, in our estimation, expected that they would spend the funding. If they don't spend the funding, the opportunity cost of that is that that money could have been spent on some other citizens in need. So we also view those as very serious matters, and obviously greater cooperation between all the stakeholders in that budget process, I think, you know, will get us over time even closer and closer to where we need to be, particularly also considering the fiscal circumstances that we find ourselves in now. We do not have, you know, financing to be allocating to a particular department, and the department is not spending that funding. Then in terms of the question around the unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure and what it entailed, if you turn in last year's adjusted estimates to page 9, there's table 4 there. It indicates per department what the unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure was. Yes, Roman numeral 9. And unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure is expenditure which departments could not have anticipated, but it's something that they are forced to spend on it might be contractual, it might be a disaster, and so on, and hence they need to spend in order to be able to ensure service delivery. Then in terms of the adjustments around the wage bill, there you'll get more information on Table 5. Just a correction to say that it's not correct to say that on budget we have an increase in the wage bill that is below the inflation rate. That has not been the case. And in actual fact, the compensation of employees, as was also raised by the Honourable Matamela, has been increasing. This wage, you know, this balance between personnel spending and other spending. And if you analyse what has been happening in the South African budget, you'll see that basically it's the cost, the unit cost, it's the wage increase that is driving that. And at some point, it's correct to look at that balance, because at some point that may mean that the trade-off is that you cannot increase the capacity of the department because you are increasing the cost of the same employees. So that is obviously an important balance to follow, and that's why the information by economic classification is so important. So you can see the underspending, for example, on capital relative to what was projected. You can see that by looking at the economic classification, and you can see that the personnel, the current expenditure, and then the breakdown of that into personnel is growing quite rapidly on budget. Another important, while I'm talking about issues driving the budget expenditure, is also the cost of servicing the debt. The interest cost of that is also a big budget driver.
I don't know if all the questions have been responded to.
The March site and the procurement plan have not responded to this.
The quarterly reporting, essentially I was saying that in terms of the new strategic plans and annual performance planning guidelines, the national departments will now need to, going forward then from next financial year, have quarterly performance reports, formal quarterly performance reports against their strategic plan and their annual performance plan, in other words, to reinforce those planning documents, and that Parliament will decide, but I would imagine Parliament may want those reports also furnished to them. Then in terms of the March spike, I think it falls in with what I was saying about planning broadly, and that we look at the costing details, we look at the estimates that are sent to us in databases, we look at the other planning documents that departments have, and basically we only propose expenditure in terms of a budget if we feel a level of confidence that the money will be expended. But somehow, you know, institutions are not always run according to those plans. In fact, even just for your information, that at the beginning of the financial year, while we do table the budget in February, which has the totals, we actually ask the departments on a monthly basis to show us the drawdown of that in terms of their plans. They even provide us with that, and yet somehow, you know, in some cases they miss it by a long shot. So I think we agree with Parliament that is quite frustrating, and that, as I've mentioned, you know, the opportunity cost of that is that money could have been better spent. And that, you know, to make it even worse, we're paying interest on that money because it's not like we're running a surplus. So we share those concerns and would like to work together further in addressing that with the institutions. But there I think Parliament has more power than we do.
Just in terms of the procurement plans for this year, we sent contact, let us know it's a little bit late. So we do have procurement plans for this year that came only at the end of August, but from next year they will be available from upfront from April. And that will be any procurement over 500,000 rand. So for some departments it will be a really, really long list. Our sense, and I deal with, I don't deal with infrastructure departments. I think that the situations may be a little bit more complicated when you need to tender. But our sense is that departments underestimate the time it takes to run a thorough tender process. And so when Dr. Brown was talking about the drawings, you know, they get you appropriate the appropriation for the year, and then you ask, can you please give us your monthly expected drawings? Then they just divide by 12. Now, you know that's not right, because some things are going to, you're not going to do everything divide by 12. Personnel, yes, you will divide by 12. But if you plan ahead, you know, for capital, I'm going to have to get the final designs, etc., etc. So, but that you need to ask. It's a departmental specific kind of thing. I think the one that do infrastructure may have a little bit more capacity for that kind of planning, although maybe I may also just be wrong, that maybe education is very good at planning, because that's what, you know, that is the department I'm responsible for.
Okay. If there are no follow-ups, we'll proceed. However, National Treasurer says no, Parliament is better placed. The only department actually that is in the Constitution is this department, Department of Finance. And the Public Finance Management Act as well says National Treasury should do certain things. Now, I think that the question that is being raised here is whether National Treasury or Provincial Treasuries. It's not saying, PFMA is not saying that you will sit there, you wait for Department A to say, we need 100 rand this month, and you give them 100 rand as the next month. It says you should do certain things. But the question is whether those certain things are done. If we read, for instance, 6.2, to the extent necessary to perform the functions mentioned in subsection 1, the National Treasurer must blah, 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 must monitor and assess implementation of this act, including any prescribed norms and standards in provincial departments, in public entities, and constitutional norms. D, may assist departments and constitutional institutions building their capacity for efficient, effective, and transparent financial management. E, may investigate any system of financial... So, it's not just a passive, what you call it, the player. The Act, Constitution, requires that National Treasury plays an active role.
You can't just be a grandpa dishing out streets there. No. Say that you do something, you ensure that this... So, I think that's what is being raised here.
But the treasuries, their roles. So, well, we might understand that you don't want to be seen as super department. But the Constitution, the PFMA, so requires, so demands that at least you do this. Well, Parliament as well. I'm not talking about Parliament. But let's... hear the next presentation. Let's get the next presentation. How about you, Mr.
Thank you.
enough members, we're going to have a match fight here, you know. With this arrangement for breakfast and what. Now, nobody's eating it. Now, lunch will come and somebody will make us account, you know. So, please, enjoy yourselves.
Well, to avoid the...
Okay, so I'm going to take you through reading the medium-term budget policy statement and how we determine the fiscal framework. Dr. Brown went into a little bit of detail about this, but I'm going to take you through the step-by-step process.
I'm sorry to disturb you. Honorable Hadablon, I'm informed that actually when you have not even opened your tea break, food and water, that lunch is actually ready outside, being warm. With your permission, let's just take a 10-minute break and take it, because clearly my system of asking people to serve themselves while we busy doesn't work. So let's just take a break now. 5 to 12. 10 past, we're back.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, all the members, those that are still standing, please be seated that we can carry on with our program. We will now take the following presentation on the MTBBS and the determination of the Division of Revenue Bill. For the fiscal framework, I'm correct with the fiscal framework. By Mrs. Scott. Miss, sorry. Miss, stop. Let me get the titles correct. And, yeah, you're welcome to take us through your presentation. And welcome to the researchers from Ghana. There they sit.
Ghana.
Yeah, from Ghana. Very welcome at this meeting, and you are welcome for the whole week. Enjoy the South African hospitality and the sunshine. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Okay, so just to remind everyone, I'm going to be doing a presentation on the medium-term budget policy statement and determining the fiscal framework. To start us off, just an overview of what fiscal policy actually is. It's the sustainable management of revenue, expenditure, and debt in within the context of a dynamic global and domestic economic environment. And for those of you who've been paying attention to the news, the uncertainty in the economic environment has created a lot of uncertainty in how we use fiscal policy to deal with those economic changes. So where do we start when we determine the fiscal framework that Dr. Brown mentioned in the previous presentation? She mentioned briefly the how the medium-term expenditure framework works, so the rolling three-year budgeting framework that we work with. And the development of the new outer year is taken from the baseline. And the baseline is what was allocated in the last budget that was tabled. So if we are moving from what was tabled in February this year, the 2011 budget, we take the 2011 MTEF and we construct a new baseline total for the outer year, which is now 2014-15. And this is done in consultation between expenditure planning, public finance, and the fiscal policy unit at National Treasury. As a starting point, we remove any of the once-off programs that have come to an end, and we look at the baseline to see if there are any areas that need to be shifted around and reprioritized. And then we grow the baseline by a rate that is representative of inflation and economic growth. And then we do a further analysis of the baseline to see where savings can be made. This has been very important in the last two budget processes, given the constrained fiscal environment that we found ourselves in, to really look at what we're spending our money on and to get the most from that money. This government is spending more money than any other government, and we really need to investigate whether we're getting the best value for that money and the best service delivery for that money. Then once we have a baseline, we then need to look at whether that level of expenditure is correct given the context of the economic environment. So we will update the fiscal framework for the new macroeconomic forecasts. We get two opportunities as the National Treasury to publish those forecasts. One is in October with the medium-term budget policy statement, and one is in February with the budget document. However, we go through the process every quarter of updating the forecasts. So after budget, we'll update those forecasts twice. This is in line with the release of the quarterly bulletin by the Reserve Bank. So as new economic data becomes available, we go through the forecasting process again, and we have new variables included in the framework for real GDP growth, nominal GDP, GDP inflation, the consumer price inflation, and then the consumer price inflation index. So basically, how much the economy, Mr. Brown did say that I have a habit of using terms that are not always understood, so I'll go through it a bit more slowly. So basically, how fast the economy is expected to grow, what we expect inflation, so the increase in prices, to be over the next 3 years, and then GDP inflation is an aggregate of all types of inflation within the economy. So the consumer price inflation is the basket of goods that are mainly used by households. So that's one measure of an increase in prices. But then you have increases in prices faced by producers. You also get the health inflation, which is slightly different. So those are like medical goods that increase at a rate different to the consumer goods that households use mostly. And the GDP inflation is an aggregate of all those different types of inflation within the economy. So as I said, we'll publish the forecasts now with the tabling of the medium-term budget policy statement, and then they'll be updated once more in February when we table the 2012 budget. once we have an idea of what economic performance is going to be, then we can start looking at what we expect tax revenue performance to be. We need to determine our outlook on the economy before we can look at the forecast of revenue, because revenue performs in line with economic performance. So when the economy is doing very well, then we see that revenue is higher than under other circumstances. And when the economy goes into a downward cycle or performs below what we expect, then we also see that dip in revenue. So for example, in 2009-10, when we went into recession, revenue underperformed our estimates by about 60 billion rand. So that shows you just how much revenue can change with changes in the economic cycle. So as part of the forecasting process for revenue, we sit on a committee called the Revenue Analysis Working Committee, and this committee meets in September in preparation for the October budget, and then in December and January in preparation for the February budget. And the forum is made up of representatives from Budget Office, namely mainly from Fiscal Policy, the Modeling and Forecasting Unit, Tax Policy, the South African Revenue Service, and then the Reserve Bank, and occasionally Statistics South Africa will also sit on the forum. And the forum is there to discuss performance in the revenue for the year to date, and then also to debate the trends in tax revenue given our outlook on the economy over the next 3 years. Once we know how much revenue we'd likely to get in, we can then start looking at the expenditure level again. So we've already determined a baseline. We then can look at whether we are able to add any more money to that expenditure level for new programs or to give additional funding to existing programs. And we start off by looking at the non-interest expenditure. So this is spending on everything except servicing debt, so the interest you pay on your debt. And previously, we have been fortunate, so prior to 2008-09, we were in the fortunate position that revenue was performing very well and we could add a lot of money to the baseline. And this allowed departments to come and bid for that money, not really taking much account of what they had within their budgets already. Now that we are in a very constrained environment, there's been much more focus placed on what departments already have, and then the pot available for additions has been smaller than in the past, because we are focused on returning the fiscus to a sustainable position, to a position where we are no longer funding recurrent expenditure like wages and goods and services with debt, where we have money available to provide for the next economic downturn, where we have money available to pay off our debt, which has grown quite substantially in the last 2 years. But all of these discussions take place within the medium-term expenditure committee. Previously, it was done by department. So, for example, the Department of Labor would come and talk to us and say, look, this has been our spending for the year to date, and this is what we got in the last budget. This is what we plan to do over the next 3 years. We need money for X, Y, and Z. This year, we did start it in last year's process, but the focus was improved this year, meeting by function. So we would have public order and safety as one of the functions, and this would be made up of the departments from justice and protection, police, defense, and military veterans, so all of those departments that deal with that specific function. And between them, they would look at what their strategic outcomes were and how they could use their existing budgets to meet those strategic outcomes, reprioritize towards those, and where there was money available for new programs, talk about what the most important ones out of those new programs were. and more detail will be provided in the budget document tomorrow about what decisions were taken at the MTEC meetings. Generally, between October and February, additions to baseline are not increased unless there are extenuating circumstances. So, for example, if there is a decision at Cabinet that we need to take account of a certain program that was not taken account of in the October budget document, then we will have to look at amending what we tabled in October to take account of that program or policy change. So that's when you may see additions to baseline change between the October document and the February document. So once we have determined the level of non-interest spending, we can then look at what our budget balance is likely to be, so what the difference between revenue and expenditure is likely to be, and what change there will be to our debt financing requirements. We then send the framework through to another team within Treasury, the Asset and Liability Management team, and they look at any changes to financing that are required, and they give us input on what interest we're going to have to pay on our new level of debt. And that is then added to the non-interest expenditure level to give total expenditure for the next 3 years. Once we have the full framework, we need to ensure that the budget remains credible. So budget allocations need to be reflective of inflation. This means that we need to maintain the purchasing power of expenditure. So what departments could buy last year, even with an increase in prices, they can still purchase those same goods and services, or capital goods, or pay wages to the same value, even though prices have increased. And we have always maintained that there is real growth in non-interest expenditure. This means that departments are able to do more than just meet a rise in prices. And we also look at what value spending is as a percentage of GDP. So this is an indication of government's contribution to the economy. In terms of debt management, we need to look at what our forecasts are on interest rates. Obviously, if the interest rate goes up, we face increasing debt service costs on our debt stock, so a rising interest bill. And then also real growth is important in terms of managing your debt stock over time. If you have very low growth and rising interest rates, your debt stock is likely to increase over time. Whereas if growth is increasing faster than your interest rate, then you'll find that your debt stock is much easier to manage and pay down to create that additional fiscal space to respond to future economic crises. And of course, as I mentioned when I was talking about revenue forecasting, growth in revenue should be reflective of what you expect to happen within the economy. Okay, so what is the medium-term budget policy statement? It's broadly the policy that will underlie the budget. So our thoughts on the economic outlook, the policy themes of the medium-term expenditure framework, what the fiscal stance is, and what the medium-term expenditure priorities and the division of revenue is likely to look like in February. There are only four chapters in the document, as outlined there. Chapter 3 includes a portion on tax policy and on debt management. In the budget review document, these two elements have their own chapters. So there's a whole chapter dedicated to tax policy in the budget review, and there's a whole chapter dedicated to debt management in the budget review. But because the medium-term budget policy statement is just a policy outlook, we choose to combine it all under the broad topic of fiscal policy. And then we have Annexure A, which just shows the outcomes for national and provincial expenditure for 2010-11. And then just some additional information for honourable members. This is how government accounts are structured, and when we talk about the budget balance in the medium-term budget policy statement and the budget review, we are referring to the level consolidated government accounts. So that takes account of national government, the Social Security Fund. The three that make up the Social Security Fund are the Unemployment Insurance Fund, the Road Accident Fund, and the Compensation Fund. And then we also include the RDP funds, so that's a donor funding. That then gives you your consolidated national budget. In addition to that, we take account of provincial budgets and then also extra budgetary institutions and entities. So all of those elements of government are included in the fiscal framework and the budget balance that we talk about. We don't include local government at this stage, although as National Treasury, we do monitor that information. And for certain elements of the of Chapter 3, at least, in the medium-term budget policy statement, we do look at the public sector borrowing requirement, and that includes both local government and the state-owned enterprises, or the non-financial state-owned enterprises. But broadly, when we talk about the budget balance, we talk at the consolidated government accounts level. And then this just is a more detailed outline of that picture. And then the different fiscal balances, just for anyone who is interested, the fiscal balance or the budget balance is just broadly the difference between total revenue and total expenditure. So that's expenditure on everything as well as your interest costs on debt. The current balance measures whether you are accessing, well, you are accumulating debt in order to finance recurrent expenditure. So it takes most of revenue and then takes away what you're spending on wages, goods and services like medicine and textbooks, and what you're spending on your interest payments on debt. So those are like your household groceries almost. So you'll be buying those things every month for as long as government exists. And if you are accumulating debt in order to finance those, you'll be continuing to accumulate debt and incur interest on that. So it's very important that the current balance be either at zero or in surplus. Then we talk about the primary balance, and this is mainly just a measure of your sustainability. So when your primary balance is the difference between revenue and all expenditure except what you spend on interest on your debt stock, so your non-interest spending. And when your primary balance is at zero or in surplus, it means that your debt, the increase in your debt stock is zero, so it's stable, it remains at the same level over time, or if your primary balance is in surplus, your debt stock will come down over time, because you'll be able to use that surplus over and above what you're spending on your goods and services, wages, capital, that sort of thing, to pay down your debt. So in terms of managing the fiscus over a long period of time, the primary balance is quite an important measure. Thank you, and I welcome any questions.
Honourable members, there you have it. Honourable Gelderblom, questions?
Chairperson,
on the album, just a minute. It's 12:45. Can we allow that Ms. Fanu also take us through her presentation, and then we take the questions together?
Yeah.
Just so sorry for this.
No problem.
But we have to look at our time.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to make a presentation, and hopefully it's not last but not least. So what is most probably the biggest difference between the Appropriation Bill Act and the Division of Revenue Bill Act is that the Appropriation Bill generally deals with national government budgets, and the Division of Revenue deals more with the actual details on the provincial budget, or breakdown per province, as well as the breakdown per individual municipality. So if you look at the appropriation bill, you'll get a line that says provincial conditional grant with one amount. If you then go down to the Division of Revenue Bill or Act, you'll get the breakdown per province, which then provides the details. Also, just in terms of process, how the budget process generally works, it's first the fiscal framework gets approved, which indicates how much money is available in the system. Then the Division of Revenue gets approved, and only after that the National or the Appropriation Bill gets approved. The same will happen with the amendment process as well. So this is just the outline of the presentation. And maybe what is extremely important is just to actually indicate how the spheres actually differ among themselves, because the majority of revenues are collected at the national sphere. They've got all the big revenue sources such as income tax, VAT and custom duties and the like. They're mainly a policy-making department, although they have got regional service delivery responsibilities such as policing, foreign affairs, defence and also higher education. But generally, national government's role is generally to provide policy and to prescribe norms and standards in terms of which provinces and municipalities must comply with, particularly when it comes to concurrent functions, where there's quite a lot of concurrent functions between national and the provincial sphere. Some of the examples are housing, others are education, and others are health. If you look at the provincial sphere, they've got some own revenues at their disposal, but it makes up a very small component of their overall funding mix. The majority of their funding they get from national in the form of a provincial equitable share. They also get conditional grants, but their own revenues make up less than 5% of their overall revenue pool. Then local government has also got important services to deliver, such as water, sanitation, electricity and refuse removal, but they've also got substantial own revenue sources. And the two primary revenue sources that they've got at their disposal is property rates. We all feel that every month we need to pay that bill. But we also get utility charges, such as for water and sanitation. And what municipalities do, they collect more than what it costs to provide the service, what we refer to as a surcharge. And that then also goes towards municipalities then funding general expenditure, such as roads, street lighting and the like. Because the concern is often raised that municipalities, why do they get such a small equitable share compared to what provinces get, compared to what national get? But on average, municipalities collect around 75% of their own revenues. So they're much less reliant on the fiscus. Having said that, there's 278 municipalities, and that percentage only counts for the bigger municipalities, so the top 25%. The remainder are much more reliant on transfers to fund their overall budgets. And then why do we have the Division of Revenue Bill? It's prescribed in Section 214 of the Constitution, which requires us to ensure that the funds available that Jonas indicated then gets equitably divided through the Division of Revenue process. Kay has also explained in detail the process where the budget goes through, where funds are discussed in the budget process, which then gets allocated to either a national department, a provincial sphere, or to the local government sphere. And what has strengthened the budget process quite substantially is that we've now got the functional approach, which means that the trade-offs take place within a function. For example, the one that's already been mentioned about education, but the same applies to local government as well. For example, you would have a function that deals with human settlements and local government, and they would, for example, look at water and then look at water, the resource or the dam, and then compare it to where that need is compared to reticulation infrastructure, for example, and make the necessary trade-offs as well. Then there's also conditional grants. Those are grants to meet specific national objectives, and that means you only get the money when you comply with the conditions. It's generally infrastructure-related funding, but it could also be for other key priorities, such as, for example, the National School Nutrition Program as well. And again, there's quite a lot of criteria in terms of which the vertical division should be done. They're listed in the Constitution, and they contain quite a long list. This is just to list them all. And then this just indicates what this current division of revenue looks like, the 2011-12 one, which already explains what I've explained before. But you can see that national government is getting 47% of the allocations, provinces are getting 44%, and then local government gets 8.17%. Also, what's important to note with regard to what is included in national, because national looks quite large, but keep in mind that the social grants are actually part of the national allocation as well. So that makes up quite a big proportion of that allocation. And then what is also important is that, as Kay already pointed out as well, is that this process is now subject to the Money Bills Procedure and Related Matters Act, and quite a lot of details are now submitted into the process as well. The first time when where Parliament can have a say on what is contained in the next Division of Revenue Bill is when the say, for example, the 2010 Division of Revenue Bill was submitted. Some proposals were made for the 2011 Division of Revenue Bill, which was then taken into account. Then the second time where Parliament's inputs are taken into account is the input on the medium-term budget policy statement or any of the processes that's submitted then. Then the third time, it does not come through the appropriation committees, but it does come through the sector portfolio committees is when they submit their BRRRs, where a number of recommendations are also made that's taken into account. So we need to work through all those documentation and then see how it actually impacts on the next year's budget. When we submit the budget in February, we give a detailed breakdown then of all the recommendations made by the appropriation committees, the finance committees, and all the sector departments as well, and we list and indicate how that's been taken into account as well. Some of them has got implications for allocations. Some of them do not have implications for allocations. And what is a new process, we've had it for the first time last year, is that if there's any change that impacts on the vertical share or it's got implications for provinces or municipalities, we require a Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. What is then required is that we then table a Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. This is most probably the shortest bill if we compare it to last year, because it contains basically two clauses. It basically says that the Division of there's changes and that all the schedules to the Division of Revenue Act is actually replaced. So we take the schedules 1 to 9 that deals with all the allocations, and they just get thrown out and they then get replaced with a new set of schedules. And last year what we've picked up is that it's not very easy to actually read those schedules because you do not know what is existing allocations and what are those allocations that actually change. So what we will be doing this year is that, and what is important to look at is not the act or the bill, because you won't get a lot of information. Then you should also skip past the schedules because that's also very difficult to read. But what you need to look at is firstly is what is referred to as the memorandum on the objects of the Division of Revenue Bill, which is right at the end of the bill. And that gives a detailed explanation on which allocations have changed, why have they changed, and some of the reasons can be, for example, increased salaries or due to the wage bill. Others could be because of disasters and the like. But the details and the new allocations that go then to each and every province for either the equitable share or the conditional grant will be listed, and the same will apply per province and municipalities. Then what we've also will be doing that we didn't do last year is we will also have appendices. And what that appendice will do is it will indicate what was the regional amount on the extreme left-hand side and indicate the regional amount. Then there will be a column for rollovers, and then there will be a column for adjustments, and then there would be a final column right on the right-hand side which will then indicate the total or the new amount. And so that would be much more useful than what was last year. I can unfortunately not provide it at this stage because I cannot compare it against last year, neither can we release those amounts. But you will get all the details in there, just some of the things that you could look at and to deal with some of the questions asked before. Is there is, for example, an amount that wasn't allocated at the start of the budget. It was for the school's infrastructure backlogs grant, which was unallocated at the budget. It will now be allocated third province through the adjustments budget process, and the details will then be contained in those schedules. And this is just to indicate the various schedules that we've got, which we submit in detail in the beginning of the year. We've done this. Okay, then what is also important for Parliament is what questions do they need to ask when we submit the budget or the bill? It's, does the division of revenue as it's reflected that goes to national, provincial and local, is that equitable? Is it aligned to the priorities of government? And also, what are the allocations to each municipality and province? But keep in mind that the Division of Revenue Act, and as well as the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill Act, is just the start of the process. It doesn't help if government does a very sterling job in allocating the resources, but we don't actually ensure that we get the right type of expenditure, and it's been raised earlier today as well. So what is extremely important in the process is actually that we need to go through the full cycle, and that's some of the issues we raised today as well. It starts, and the most important part of the whole process is actually to complete the full loop. The oversight responsibilities are placed with Parliament, but also provincial legislatures and also the municipal councils. It's a very important part of the process to monitor that spending is taking place, and it's also taking place on the right type of issues. Then also important, after the budget is allocated, what is important that thing translates into planning and also budgeting, and then if you look at it then goes right at the bottom, implementation and in-year reporting, and then it then ends up with the end of the year reporting, and if it wasn't up to scratch, then the Auditor General can also then hold people to account. So where the Division of Revenue Bill fits in, also where the Appropriation Bill Act falls in, is basically around the just before the operational planning and budgeting, around there. But the next two steps are critically important, is that we need to monitor then and do the in-year monitoring to ensure that the monies are correctly spent. As it relates to the Division of Revenue Bill, or Act, what happens is that there's what we refer to as a National Transferring Officer. For example, if there's a conditional grant, let's just say the Department of Transport Grant. Then there's one that goes to provinces, there's also one that goes to local government. It's the first responsibility of the National Transferring Officer or the Department of Transport, the National Department of Transport, to obtain the reports, to ensure that the plans come in, to ensure that the money is correctly spent. And if the money is correctly spent, then to release the money to the province or the municipality concerned. if the spending is not taking place, it is their first responsibility then to follow up with the municipality or the province concerned and to find out the underlying reasons why the money is not spent. Because it does not really assist if you transfer money and it just gets returned in the end of the financial year to the fiscus again because the money has not been spent. And some of the tools at the disposal of the National Transferring Officers, then if they pick up that there's slow spending or there's no spending taking place, is to delay the transfer of that money and then to report to National Treasury also on that, and also Parliament can also play a very critical role here as well. That gets done on a monthly basis, the expenditure side. On a quarterly basis, there's also performance reporting, and that all then culminates into an annual performance report as well that should also be submitted to Parliament. Some of the useful information for to monitor is actually the in-year reports, and what this just provides is the list of the type of reports that we do get. With regard to provinces, what's important to look at is what is the current level of spending on personnel. Is personnel expenditure in line with the budget that they received? If not, why is it going over? What is the current? Also, what's important is not just to look at personnel as a whole, but also look at how much of the personnel is allocated to what we refer to core staff versus admin staff. In quite a few cases, you do get cases where the admin staff is too high compared to core staff. Another important thing, for example, to try to look at is what is the current organogram or staffing establishment for a certain sector, and do they point against that organogram or do they point above that? For example, we've got one province that appointed 1,000 people that's not on their staff, that's not on their organogram. And then they complain that they don't have enough money to fund their staffing costs. Also, what we need to look at, for example, is you need to look at how much did they spend last year on personnel and what are they budgeting for this year for personnel, because we also get cases where they don't appropriately budget for personnel. They, for example, the money that goes through to them has got sufficient scope for inflation, but then the province itself under budgets for that and do not make adequate provision for personnel, and of course they will run out of money. So particularly when there's constraints on personnel in a specific province or specific sector, it's very important that Parliament also looks into that in quite a lot of detail. Another important issue to look at is also the expenditure on infrastructure. Unlike the personnel, often expenditure on infrastructure and capital is a bit below as well, which is a huge concern. And then also we do get under expenditure quite consistently on goods and services, particularly where it relates to things like medical supplies and things like that. It's a bit of a concern if there's under expenditure there. Also, in education, the same can happen if you've got like school books and things like that is under purchased. How do you actually train children? So those are the type of things that we should go into and look in quite a lot of detail and then take corrective action there. Then with regard to municipalities, again, we've got quite a lot of information on our website that's quite useful. Some of it also gets provided to Parliament, and it also, again, contains the same type of information, but for different sectors as well. And the things that need to be monitored is, again, what is happening with personnel, do they spend on their conditional grants, do they make adequate provision for free basic services and providing services to the indigent and things like that. And these are critical processes in ensuring that we complete the full loop from giving the resource allocation until ensuring that it's correctly spent. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Wanu.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the presentations here this morning.
My question is that over the years we had the same problem, and that is that about the criteria when it comes to the allocations of department's budgets. Now, to what extent does Treasury take into account the past performance of the departments when allocating of the budget of the departments take place? And I want to make an example, and that is that you have some departments that have been receiving disclaimers and even qualified audit reports, opinions, but they are still receiving budget increases on a yearly basis. So my question is, how strong is the criteria in this regard? Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions? What we experienced when we visited provinces quite recently in the Northwest province, where the provincial department indicated that they spent the money on the conditional grants for libraries, but when you get to a specific area, you are looking for where the library is, and nothing actually happened. Or you are being advised by Public Works, they build a bridge, but you, when you get to the river, there's no bridge, like in Limpopo,
not even a river,
where we had to walk for half. No, there were water, but and we had to walk for half a kilometer
looking for the bridge.
But the building material is lying there on the banks of the river, but the contractor is not there. That's where provincial legislators also come in, through the portfolio committees on the court, on the monitoring of the quarterly reports, dealing with the quarterly report, but going out, doing the oversight outside, to have your finger on the pulse. And we must look at that and see how we can do things differently to get a better value for money and to deliver to our people outside. I just want to make this remark regarding our experiences. Thank you. You may respond. You want to ask a question? Honorable Shukoni?
Thank you, Chairperson. Did I lose it? No, I'll come back, Chair, later. But I just want to make a comment. You know, on page 2 of the first presentation about the budget levers, the one about the fiscal policy. Now, on page the slide 6 says that additions to baseline may change the between MPBS and budget, but only in extenuating circumstances. You know, earlier, Chairperson, you made a remark that maybe in future workshops of this nature, we should invite other committees as well. I think we should, because if people really understand this part, that, I mean, what this morning has been said over and over, the importance of Parliament's comments, whether it's in terms of the PRR and what, if we can understand that, so that we really understand the input that Parliament can make to in the budget, because obviously I'm preaching to the converted here, because we do know that what will come during budget time in February, it's not going to matter too much, because the budget is there.
Now, this is the time.
This is the basis.
This is the time. And I think that may be the message that we should convey to other, what you call, colleagues, to say it's very important for them to take this process seriously at this stage. And what we have not added, by the way, I don't see it here, is also the recommendations that FFC make, you know, and maybe the comments to those recommendations by Parliament, by legislatures, and I know that from our side, maybe we have not yet tightened the role from our side as Parliament, especially as National Parliament, in terms of consolidating our own comments to National Treasurer in terms of those recommendations. Now it's FSC versus National Treasury, and I don't think that it should be like that. The allocation to local government. I think that the assumption here or at National Treasury is that local government is monolithic. It is the same all over. If you take Mir in the Northern Cape and you compare it with Johannesburg or any other metro or just small municipalities out in the rural areas which do not have a base to generate what we call revenue, then we assume that now they have to generate revenue. But we don't indicate from what. People are unemployed there. Because if you take the national average of unemployment, it says about 26% of people are unemployed. But if you break down that and see where is this 26% lies, it lies there in the rural area. 70% of the people are not employed. But we are expecting that municipality to contribute. So if perhaps our budgeting can take that into account, so that we don't just assume that they will generate revenue when they are not what you're calling able to generate revenue. Application of that plan. Yeah. No, thank you, Chairperson.
Mrs. Stott and then Mrs. Swanu regarding the questions. You know what came to you.
Thank you very much for your comments. I can just mention briefly that maybe I didn't make it clear on the slide. We do take account of the BRRRs and the recommendations from the FFC. That obviously is a very important part of the process. In terms of determining the overall fiscal framework, we deal more with the aggregate numbers. So Wendy can deal more with the specifics of the recommendations and how it filters into changes in the division of revenue.
Thank you very much. I've got the bulk of the questions. The first one is, do we take past performance into account? And the answer is yes and no. The reason why I say yes and no is because it will differ. For example, there's, and I'm just talking about provinces and local government, not national. With regard to provinces as well as local governments, they're firstly entitled to an equitable share. That equitable share is determined in terms of a formula, and it's equitably divided in terms of the provinces, per individual province in terms of a prescribed formula. The same applies with regard to local government. You cannot be penalized because you, you do not perform up to the required level. Where it is taken into account is, and again, the answer with regard to conditional grants would be yes and no. And it's quite a tricky question because you need to actually take into account in certain cases who's the loser if you lose or if you reduce the allocation, say, on a conditional grant to a province or a municipality. It's the person that needs to get that service. So the issue that you need to look at is what is causing that underperformance? Is it that the conditional grant is not correctly structured? Is it that a municipality is receiving a conditional grant that it shouldn't be receiving through that type of conditional grant, or what is the underlying reason? So it's quite a complex exercise. And some departments are actually better at doing it than other departments. For example, on the one of the conditional grants the municipal roads one, there's been a process put in place where National Treasury, together with the National Department of Transport, met with the municipalities concerned that's getting that conditional grant. And what was determined that grant is much more structured towards public transport solutions, which are much more applicable to very large metropolitan areas and not so much smaller municipalities where that type of public transport system is not appropriate. So what needs to be done is the national department needs to relook at its public transport policy to make a public transport policy in place that works for a metro that's got over 3 million people. Compare that against another secondary town that's got, say, 500,000 people, because the two solutions are not the same. And, for example, those are the type of details that sometimes need to be looked at conditional grants as well. So the answer is it will differ per department, that is actually an area that a lot of attention needs to be given towards, is when there's underperformance on conditional grants, to determine what is the underlying reason. Because it's not always just capacity constraints. It could be capacity constraints, but there could be a number of reasons as well. Then with regard to the issue about provincial conditional grants and there's expenditure listed, but there's no performance, i.e. there's no library or there's no breach, that's very serious. And I can but not just agree with what the Honourable De Beer had to say about the role of provincial legislatures. But it's also important that the national transferring officers also ensure that their monitoring systems are in place that these type of things just does not happen. So if Parliament also picks something up like that, it would be very appropriate to call the province concerned, but also the national transferring officer concerned, to ask them to please account why is this happening. Then with regard to the question about the allocations to local government and that the 278 municipalities are all different, we fully agree with that, some municipalities are nearly fully reliant on transfers is also acknowledged. What is quite tricky is that with regard to rural areas, you get largely, and I know it's more complex than that, but you can actually break rural areas into two areas as well. You get rural areas that where you've got a relatively small population with quite a large area. And you get that predominantly in Northern Cape, for example. But you also get, for example, other rural areas which are quite densely populated. They've got very large densification as well, with quite a large number of poor people as well. So you cannot have one solution in those areas as well. So you need actually a multiple approach towards the funding of municipalities as well. And we started moving in that direction already, where we've started to convert the conditional grant system as well, where there's now specific grants that target more urban areas, and then you get specific grants that target more rural areas in the country as well. But that doesn't mean that we're at the end of it. There's definitely much more work that needs to be done in this regard. But the system are starting to respond to these type of differences as well. Then with regard to the issue about the recommendations by the FFC and government's response, we generally provide the feedback there when we formally table the budget in February of that year, and then we indicate to what extent it's been taken into account or not taken into account. Hopefully I've answered all the questions. Thanks.
Any follow-ups? None?
Sorry. Now, the issue that we were saying, Chairperson, about the recommendations of FFC to National Treasury is that maybe we, this side, as Parliament, we should also engage with those recommendations so that when National Treasury responds, we're able to understand, I mean to agree or not to agree with National Treasury, because we have engaged with them, with the departments directly. It's quite correct that National Treasury will respond to them, but we must be able also to engage with them so that if they are not agreed upon, we can also understand why is it that they are not agreed upon, can be able to engage at that level. Thank you.
On the 3rd and the 4th of October, the FFC conducted public hearings on the fiscal framework for local government, which was a very, very important exercise. And we're looking forward to the outcome of those public hearings, because that will give the way forward and to assist us regarding the funding for local government and municipalities. Maybe in November, yes. I didn't receive an indication, but we will have to be vigilant and engage with the FFC when that is made public, the outcome of the hearings. Our colleagues from north of South Africa, if you want to make an input, you're welcome. Any remark, any observation?
No, sorry, Chair. I think that what they would like to make a short presentation regarding the association. About the association and where do we fit in terms of that association, after which then maybe we may summarize. Starting not very much in a hurry to leave. Mr. Sex. 2 minutes. They might, they are welcome to leave. And, as long as they just contribute for lunch before they leave.
Is he still making input?
No.
You? So you're going to leave us now. But thank you for taking us through this workshop, sharpening us, to make us more vigilant to do our work better. Thank you very much. We'll see you the rest of the week. Actually, until the end of November. Yeah. All part of the financial family. But, thank you very much. You may make your submission, your presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, as indicated before, we have an interim committee on the SADC Association of Budget Committees, primarily for the sake of wanting to exchange views and ideas and to learn from each parliament, but in relation to getting the SADC to account in terms of management of resources for the country's people. I think the budget process is one of the most important events in the calendar year of parliament. And particularly in our case in Zimbabwe, we have made some improvements, because naturally the issue of budgeting was that it would pass through Parliament rather than Parliament passing budget. And the executive really would just take it for granted that when it comes to Parliament, it was a day's event. And through the association and through the change of programs with various countries, we have come a long way. We have learned a lot. Where in actual fact as well, there's an element where the budget process starts by getting people to make an input in the budget process, in the budget formulation itself, and also to interact with the ministry, and also to have a parliamentary pre-budget seminar, leading also to the presentation of the budget in Parliament, and getting at least 2 weeks or so to reflect back and unpack the budget so that it becomes a better Parliament for debate. So the reason why we think obviously South Africa also plays a role is that because of its big economic position, and also because what we have learned, it is important that this association gets the backing of South Africa as well, so that we have a platform where even training, we can hold some of these trainings, these workshops together to, as I said, to interact and to change, to change views and to learn from each other. Particularly when you look at Africa, really, the issue of accountability, the issue of management of the continent resources is a very, very big problem. And therefore, we see the importance of this association going forward. I think briefly, that's what we think the role of the association will be. And unless Rongai, at the moment, the secretariat is being provided free of charge by an organization called the Southern African Parliamentary Support Trust, which is an organization that is our cooperating partner in the Zimbabwe Parliament until it takes from the ground. So Rongai is from that organization, and if you, Rongai, feel free that you want to add a bit of it, you can. Please, thank you.
I won't put across much, but just probably to talk about the programs of the association more specifically. The association had an inception planning meeting in Harare in July 2010, and at that planning session was able to attract the attendance of South Africa, Namibia, Zambia, which is here, and Swaziland. And that meeting resolved that an interim steering committee be put in place, made up of the chairpersons of budget committees who had attended that meeting. And that's when Honorable Janda was given that mandate to steer the chairmanship of the association. And SAPST, which I represent, was then assigned to take much more of a secretariat role. And we, as the interim secretariat, were then mandated to create a program or a work program for the association, which key among the work program was to provide capacity building sessions for members of budget committees of SADC regions. And beyond that, we have been able to host quite a number of meetings. I must emphasize that since the inception of the program, we have seen the membership growing up to about 8 from about 4 then. We've been able to also draw the attention of Mozambique. We've been able to draw in the attention of Angola. We've been able to draw in the attention of Botswana. And in February this year, there was another session held in Harare where we were training on budget monitoring and tracking. And it's very interesting that the issues of budget monitoring and tracking are very important, because this is what brings up the issues which have been talked about, where you could have your quarterly reports presented in Parliament in portfolio committees, but if you don't physically go on the site where the bridge is being built to match the performance report and the actual implementation, then you have got an information gap. And as Parliament might continue to ratify expenditure which is not linked to actual impacts and outcomes. And so we as a secretariat have got a program which tries to assist Parliament to have the capacity and tools to deal with that capacity bottleneck, so that the issues of oversight, which the chairman has been talking about and which we are dealing with today, you can be able to
assert that power. There is no reason why you can have a constitution, you can have a Public Finance Management Act, which gives you the power as parliament. But taking that power and employing it is a totally different ballgame. It requires skills. It requires this stamina. It requires some of this assistance. And that's what this secretariat is trying to deal with. And in February, the membership which was there then resolved to ratify the constitution, and seven members were able to ratify that constitution, which constitution now provides the association a corporate governance framework to be able to discharge its responsibility. And South Africa was not there at that meeting, but unfortunately, the members which were there were able to generate the critical mass required to ratify the constitution, because the constitution requires six members to ratify for it to be able to become operational. And with effect from 1 April this year, the constitution is now operational. And going forward, we feel strongly that South Africa, given the type of capacity and good budgetary processes which have been talked about today, there is a lot to draw from for other members of the association. So South Africa's involvement will be very interesting. In fact, the international budget project, which does the open budget index, is rated South Africa as the highest or the best country in terms of an open budget framework. And we really cherish that it's coming in to SADC. And we are now telling the global world that we can also have very transparent budgetary systems. And in terms of parliamentary access to information, it too came up tops. But I think what is more important is processing the information, and that processing requires capacity like the association. It requires capacity to be able to unpack that information. So in that regard, we wish to emphasize that we're excited to be here, and I'm excited to have brought my two chairpersons to be able to also understand the meetings you hold before the budget policy statement is presented. It's emphasizing transparency in terms of how you interact with your treasury. And it is very good practice which we would also want to share with our other members when we go back. Just to leave you with the understanding that we would want this association to grow, and for it to grow, it requires more members. And once we have a region-wide influence in terms of our operations as an association, we'll be influencing more budgetary outcomes in our respective parliaments. Thank you very much, Chairman.
Very much. Commonwealth Parliament Association, the Africa region, also has a structure within where we communicate with the countries north of us. And maybe we must spend more time on this topic regarding accountability, coming to budgets, etc. And then APEC, the Association of Public Accounts Committees, I know invites you regularly to the workshops and annual conference, which was held in the Northern Cape, yes, in September. Honourable members, well, thank you very much. I'm going to ask the Honourable Chikwoni just to do the concluding remarks for us, seeing that he started the session this morning. Honourable Chikwoni.
Well, thank you very much, Honourable members. Must also thank our colleagues of the SADC Parliamentary Forum Association for coming. But I think that South Africa will, what you call it, participate. But I'm sure you have recognized that we're not only national parliament. We have got provincial legislatures that at the end we should take into account. So our mandate is not just a short mandate. If we're not there yet, it doesn't mean that we're boycotting you. We would like to be part of, we are part of SADC, we would like to be part of SADC. And to National Treasury, thank you very much for this presentation this morning. But I think that the question that maybe we need to engage with moving forward is, how do we ensure that this process really generate interest for those members, for all members who are not here to want to come. I think that is important. The presentations are good. They give us an idea in terms of how the MTBBS is going to look like. And it's important that not only the finance committees understand this, all committees of parliaments, whether in subnational parliaments, have an understanding of this in order for us to be able to do oversight. Unless we understand what is contained in the PFMA, what is contained in the money bills, how these relate to these allocations, we will not be able to make our people out there, our society, to benefit from these programs of government. And I'd like to also, on behalf of the committee, express our gratitude to the research unit of Ghana for visiting us. We know Makana Makana represented us in the World Cup. Thank you very much for doing that. We hope that in the next World Cup you reach the semi-finals on behalf of Africa. And thank you very much for coming. Please, we don't want before Parliament ask us to account for wasteful and what expenditure. Let's please enjoy ourselves. I thought that I would request to go there to organize a second lunch for us, but we can't finish the first one. So thank you very much, honorable members and colleagues. You know, the support that we always receive from FFC, we can't really express.